So we've got Mr. Mo Omar.
Yeah.
How are you, Mo?
Good, good. I didn't realize that from Walthamstow to here, if you catch the overground, it's only 4 stops.
Yeah.
But I would have stupidly caught the underground. So I would have been on the underground. So I don't know. I'm kind of disappointed in myself. It's like when I realized that when we used to live in High Barnet, that there's a train that goes from High Barnet all the way to Highbury and Islington directly. Instead of catching the Northern Line all the way down there, they're catching the Victoria Line. I mean, this is a very London-centric issue.
Also, thanks for the TFL update, mate. Cheers for that. I'm planning my journey home right now.
And Citymapper lies to you a lot.
Does it?
Yeah, it reroutes. I think it reroutes you on its own so that you don't end up like making the place really busy.
Do you really think that?
Well, I'm not a conspiracy theorist, but...
Sounds like you are, mate. I think it gives me the right route every time. It wants me to be there. It says, you're not going to clog up the place. Don't worry about it. With Mo, it says, catch bus. This, tuk-tuk.
Walk now. And the other voice is Mr. Ross Smith. How are you doing, Ross?
Hello. I'm well, thank you. No travel badness at all. Oh. It's fine. I got here in plenty of time. Went to a cafe down the road. It was called Cafe Open. It was open. I went in, got myself a... What happens when they shut? That's what I want to know.
What did you eat? Did you eat food?
No, I didn't eat food. Got myself an Oasis.
Oh.
If Oasis want to send me any free stuff, that would be lovely. I love Oasis.
Imagine if the one person who listened to this was an Oasis representative. Like, God, we lucked out there, guys.
Yes.
Because I'm Essex, so when it comes to... So where you're Walthamstow in London, you live.
I'm not Walthamstow, but I was just in Walthamstow, so...
Where are you based?
Southall.
So where... Because I don't... other than like the main sort of areas of London, I don't really know like the individual characters of each environment. So what's Southall like about?
Southall's a very Asian-orientated community. It's very like immigrant. Well, I mean, most people are probably third generation, but it's great because if you go on the Broadway, prices are still as if London hasn't happened there.
Oh, okay.
And for example, you can go to get these things called corn in a cup, where they steam these sweet corn, and they put in a little pot, and they put a bit of butter in there, a bit of salt, and then whatever flavor you want. There's like 100 flavors you can get, from pickle to hot chili to mustard. You put it in there, and they close the top and they shake it.
That sounds
And then
good.
You get, and it's all for £1. And it's so filling. It's so nice. And it's like, and there's enough salt in there to like perk you up.
Oh, good stuff. One of the old ladies, old people have a ridiculous amount of salt. Mm. One of the old ladies I care for, she literally pours like a mound of salt into her palm and then puts that on her food. And
why do they need a lot of salt?
I don't know. I don't know. Because they're already dry. Dry people. Old people are dry people. So you'd think they'd need something a bit more moist.
Yeah.
But they're like, it's like they're slowly like pickling themselves.
Yeah, they're preserving before it happens.
What? Oh, no. I'm surprised at that. I thought old people would hate it.
No, they love it.
Do they like their food mashed and liquidy?
Yeah.
If they've got certain needs, they have to have like pureed food and stuff like that.
Oh, what's the point at that point?
That's living, isn't it? Yeah. Imagine that, having pureed food. Great.
I mean, you do it on your way in and you do it on your way out.
Yeah. Speaking of that, while we're on the subject of old people, one of my colleagues, her little boy was in the care home the other day, and she went, I have like a book on me, like of jokes, or not jokes, but just ideas or premises or jump off points for ideas. Mm. And she went, oh, that's like Pope's like book of comedy. Like, let's have a look. Show Alex your comedy. Show me comedy. I was like, no. She's like, go on, just show him your comedy. He opened it up, and the first thing it said was, the reason people with dementia stay alive for so long is because they forget to die. And that was the funny gag that he can take to school with him. So
show and tell.
Yeah,
that's fucking great. Because I bet you she like delivered it with such a like the reason that
she
doesn't say a lot is because they forget to. Oh well, you know,
they forget to die. Yeah. Come on, and I got it written up for that.
I got it written up for that.
Okay.
But you didn't even offer. Did you offer up your book?
I gave it because I opened it up on a page that I thought was like, okay, I know that page isn't too bad. Like there's stuff about worms in there, or just something quite friendly. Mm. And I forgot that that bit was at the top of the page. So,
mate, no, just don't take your book along to work.
No, it's all right. It's I've come up with ideas, and I'm a great carer. I get away with murder there. I could like.
Don't say that as a carer, mate. Fucking hell, Jesus Christ!
Get away with literal murder.
Yeah,
then otherwise
I get away with murder. Imagine that though. That's like the sort of modern age sort of artist, isn't it? Having to like work these jobs and then having to like Bernard Manning must have never gone through that. Do you know what I mean?
No,
like Bernard, can I have a look at your joke book? Well, I don't think you should. I don't think you should.
But no, I quite like that because I remember I spoke to a comic early on when I was doing comedy, and it's someone I won't name who it is. I don't want to see. I don't know. It might be a bit offensive, but the person who it was, when I spoke to them about being a carer as well, they were like, "Wait, you do like comedy and care work? That's mad! Like that's unbelievable. I've never met anyone who does that." And I was thinking, it's good to have, like, you do understand it at the beginning, like, you have to have
another job.
Yeah, you have to.
Although there was a guy who we were speaking to, and we were speaking to my girlfriend, he was just like, oh, you know, I've just quit my job and taking the comedy more seriously. And I was like, oh, okay, cool, man. And then he said, oh, how many gigs have you done? And then my girlfriend was like, oh, I've done about 100. Which is a relatively low number, and he went, wow. Oh, I've only done 40.
Yeah.
And it's like, what, you've quit your job already?
That is mad. That is the delusion, though. That's like, that just utter, like you're detached from reality at that point.
Yeah,
or you just have an, like, I can't think of the word, just your complete assurance in what you're doing.
I don't think it's assurance. I think it's naivety and a bit of delusion. And he does a character which is like what's that East End actor who's you're only supposed to blow the double
Michael
doors.
Caine. Yeah,
he does a Michael Caine, but like the Asian version of Michael Caine.
Oh my god!
Well, it sounds hilarious. He was right to quit his job. Yeah. That is going to run. I mean, the thing about it is that like I as you know, MC that night, Comedy Virgins, right? The audience don't know that, but you fuckers do, right? Instantly from people's reactions to comedy, like when people get into comedy and they're like a bit unsure of themselves and they're kind of a bit whatever, I think you're probably going to be all right. Yeah. But when somebody comes into it with that, like, I think like society has sort of bred us to think, right, you come out of school and you go after something and you go after it with gusto and you do this.
Yeah,
whereas
yeah.
like when people get involved with that in comedy, I'll see people jump up on stage and like run to the stage and jump on, grab the mic stand. I think, oh, you're going to die on your ass.
Yeah, you just know. Or the ones who do shadow boxing before they go on stage.
I used to do press ups before I was on stage, to be fair.
I used to go to the back alley and go over my set, and the amount of times people walked past and just saw what they thought was like a mental.
I have a hot tonk. I like a shit. I have a shit and then go over my notes every.
Have a shit if they had
it's
a bidet.
Nice, it centers me. It centers me, and it also, but because of the I think the adrenaline as well just forces me to evacuate myself.
No, but I would do that. I do regularly need one. But I need to wash my butt afterwards. That's my culture.
Wet wipes, mate. I'll carry a bag of wet wipes.
So that doesn't count. It doesn't feel the same.
I can't believe you said that's your culture. That's my culture. We were built on clean asses. That's what we were built on.
That's what my father did and his father before him.
Father, when I was 13, took me to the side and he showed me a bidet. You might think that's something you drink out of, mate. But
that
no.
That is you being baptised, sitting on the bidet.
I don't know, before a gig, I think like I've just learned to not give a shit to the point of like I pretend that I'm not even doing a gig like before I'm doing it, and the only time that I worry about it is when they call my name. That's it. I'm on my way to the stage. I think they're like
time to worry.
No, yeah, I know, but I like, get that. I'm at that stage now where I don't ever get nerves before a gig, really. It's like a low hum maybe in my stomach, but really I don't get nervous at all.
Mate,
I always think no gig is like make or break, or like there's not like there's never really any anything at stake. So I always just go on and think, oh, I'll try and...
It's just showing weakness, isn't it? And that's all it is. It's
showing weakness? What are you, Spartacus?
Yeah, no. I am. I want to stand up and tell you, I am Spartacus.
It's just a micro.
No, but I don't, like, I think that a lot of it is acting the part, isn't it? You know, and if somebody's nervous, then the audience is going to recognise that. And
I pace the shit out of it before I go on. And then it was... It's because I can't get blackout drunk anymore before I go on stage, and I'm just like, oh god, now I gotta deal with all these feelings.
That's the point, isn't it? You were always hammered. Remember. Yeah.
And then suddenly, like, when you have to do 20 minutes, and I'd be cooking under my skin because I'd be dehydrated from having drunk like 4 or 5 pints. And black people don't blush, so no one can tell. But I'd be like overheating to the point when I'd come off stage, I'd have to like dunk my face in water.
Well, for the first year and a half of me doing comedy, each gig I had like 50 hydrocodone tablets in my system.
Yeah, it's the only way you can get by.
Or morphine or oxycodone. Yeah. I can't actually say the name of the gig because they won't ever have me back. I was really new. I was lucky to get on a gig. It was with Romesh, Nick Helm and Bridget Christie. It was like a kind of a really solid
lineup.
Bill. It's terrible. Like, I went out, it was like the biggest gig I'd done up to that point. And I went out there and I done like relatively well, I think. But felt nothing at all. I was just completely numb.
Yeah,
to it,
that
completely
was
dead inside.
I missed that. I missed that feeling of, and I think it comes with experience. Like now when I do a new material night, I don't feel that same, but that transfer onto like doing longer. That was I'd start doing longer and I couldn't drink anymore before I go on stage. I'm just like, ah, damn it, now I have to deal with all these feelings that open micers would have dealt with when they were back in open mic.
Yeah.
Well, again, I think that's the kind of thing, like, if you see somebody off stage who's like sort of taking all the plaudits of like a good gig, you're like, for me, that's like, oh, I haven't got the right attitude, because I think like when I get off stage, even if I've done stupidly well, I'll be going like, well, you said that word wrong.
Yeah.
And you said this bit
wrong.
Yeah,
exactly. And I never had that before. Now the moment I'm off stage, you're already looking back over the gig, and I'm like, before I'd be like, ha ha, another drink.
And
just kind of forget. And I never learnt anything. It would take me 5 gigs to learn one joke.
Yeah.
Just because you'd have no memory of how you said stuff.
And also, you know for a fact that the crushing post gig low is only just around the corner, and sooner or later you're going to have to get back on the tube and there's just going to be silence, and you're going to be thinking, you're going to be looking at everybody going, like, about an hour ago I was making a whole room full of people laugh and all
dare
of you
not recognise tube carriage.
It's just such a weird like juxtaposition. It's like working like, so I'll like do like teaching assistant like with like one-to-one with like autistic kids, and like it's stuff times during the day where I just think, this is a harsh new reality compared to last night. Compared to last night, where I was like gigging with Ramesh Ranganathan, and now I'm just like looking after you. This is weird. Yeah. Like, you should know.
Recognize, kid. Yeah, recognize. No, it's funny. It's an up and down thing. Pope.
Well, no, mood for me is very fleeting anyway. So when I was on drugs, it's to keep an emotion in a fixed position. So you take a certain amount of drugs, you get ecstasy, you know, ecstatic high for an hour or whatever it is, and you keep that now down. Whereas with normal mood, it tends to drift. And so my any enjoyment, it goes... It dissolves very quickly, very quickly.
Because first of all, ecstasy doesn't last for an hour. How fast was your body processing?
I don't know. I'm not talking about
an hour.
I'm not talking about the drug ecstasy. I'm talking about the feeling ecstatic high off the back of opioids.
I thought your liver could just process.
Yeah, yeah.
Such a heavyweight. Last an hour.
When I was in the midst of kind of addiction on opioids, I would take ecstasy and it had no impact.
Fuck
it had up. Nothing. Damn. It did nothing. So it was counteracted by the sedative effect of the opioids.
I did ket once.
I love Care. And I did. Mate, I fucking
I didn't like it. It just made me a bit sad, and then I went home.
That's when you haven't done enough.
That doesn't feel like it.
You've got to push to the point. So like you even kind of push beyond the K-hole. So you get the K-hole and you're like, oh my God, I'm in this like dark, reclusive kind of bulb in the floor. And then you push past that and then it gets good and gets fun. And
I just don't want to
be the party pooper here and say drugs are bad.
They are. No, drugs are awful, but bloody lovely at the beginning. It just goes terrible for a while, but they're nice.
The whole thing of having to take more and more and more is, I remember we got done when our house in Bristol got robbed, and then the police came over and they found all the, we used to do balloons, but we stopped even doing the balloons. We just do it straight from the chargers.
And we had
boxes upon boxes upon boxes because we used to buy in bulk order. So we'd get 200 at a time and just do those in a couple hours. And then when the police came, and then they were like, oh, someone's going to come down and like do some dusting to like try and find out if there's any fingerprints. And this guy comes along and he opens my friend's cupboard and he sees the, like, and he was like, you know, last week, I think he was trying to scare us, but he was like, you know, last week I had to put a girl in a bag because she asphyxiated herself while she was sleeping. Because she did it while she was sleeping, and then she just choked. Mm. And then her friend was lying next to her and thought that she'd just fallen asleep. And so she didn't discover until the next morning.
It has effects on your respiratory system, and you die. Yeah, you can die.
But it's fun up until that point.
So this is just to go on that, because I've been reading a lot about like the Sackler family and Purdue Pharmacy, who created OxyContin. They patented OxyContin, and they were kind of like the genesis of this opioid crisis at the moment that's killed like four times more people than the AIDS epidemic. It's unbelievable. So when I was reading this article in the London Review of Books, it was describing, now this is why you become a drug addict, but it's also the thing of the tolerance. You build up a tolerance, so you keep needing to increase the amount to get this feeling. But this is the feeling, like it's just a good way of describing it. So the oxycodone experience, and by the way, with oxycodone, it's what's in OxyContin. And the only way, actually, I've got to kind of talk about this in a, I knew someone who, in the care home, you've got so many controlled substances where there's people who are obviously elderly or terminal, they need this to manage pain.
Yeah.
This person set a moral threshold of like they would never deprive the elderly people of their drugs because they need it for a legitimate reason. But then this person found a loophole in that when they die, the drugs get written off as wastage. So that person would then pillage the medicine cabinet and just down bottles of oxycodone. And I remember this person once, because they found out that in order to stop people using it when it's wastage, they pour it on cat litter. They pour it in cat litter so it's like unusable now. So this person swallowed a big mouthful of cat litter just to try and get the effect of the oxycodone. So,
but why was
this
put on cat litter?
Around and go, and that person was me.
No. But why, first of all,
is someone very close to me, very close.
But why would that person? Why would they first of all put it on cat litter?
You have, because that's the regulation. So legally speaking, in hospitals and in care homes and that, you have to put it on cat litter because they think, okay, well, obviously no one's going to swallow a big lump of cat litter to try and get the effect of this stuff. That's just like...
They grate it onto cat litter?
No. It's liquid. So it's any liquid substance. So oxycodone, you pour it onto the cat litter. So the cat litter absorbs it. Mm-hmm. They obviously think, okay, well, no one's going to swallow cat litter, but
some people
one person did.
Rest in peace, that person.
So
rest in peace.
So this was in the article, and it's kind of the best thing I've read for those of you who haven't taken drugs. This is why you get addicted to this sensation. So the oxycodone experience is difficult to describe to an opiate virgin. Personally, I feel as if I have suddenly gained all that I want in my life and no longer have anything to fear. I am perfectly content, both mentally and emotionally. All the tension slips from my body and I feel warm and utterly comfortable, as if I were sitting beside a roaring fire wrapped in a delicate cashmere blanket. That bit's a bit wanky, but rocking gently back and forth. Communication is pleasant but unnecessary. Under the influence of oxycodone, no companionship is needed. I accept myself and the world just as we are, not begrudgingly, but eagerly, ecstatically even.
Whoa.
And that's something everyone wants to attain. That.
No, I just wanted to get high, like clubby high. I never wanted the.
I wasn't a social drug user. Even if I went to parties in order to get hold of the drugs, I'd have like 4 grams of stuff on myself, and then like a party boy gram that I'd share. And like, yeah, well, I'm part of the party, guys. Yeah. But then I'd be secretly in the toilet with the 4 grams on my own, and I even would put a plastic bag yeah. over my head so people couldn't hear me snorting. Because if they heard me snorting, they'd go, "Oh, have you got more stuff in there? Like, can we share?" And I didn't want to share.
That's the darkness.
That's when it stops being like a. And becomes
Exactly. So on that upbeat note,
Jesus.
There's actually someone introduced me at a gig the other day. Said, "Speaking of heroin, please welcome to the stage, Mr. Pope Lonergan." And it was the nicest thing anyone's ever said about me.
Like one word things. Did a gig, lovely gig, Poodle Club. Shout out Poodle Club. They had like a rundown on Facebook, and it was me and Richard Todd were on, right? And we were the middle acts, right? And it said that the opener, right? It was like
so the listener knows, I accepted the information with no surprise on my face.
He was like, "Yeah, you two, definite middles." Yeah. Right? He goes, "This thing said like Mary Burke, like fantastic headliner. She's got razor sharp wit. All these different things." And it was like Jamie D'Souza, his one liners will leave you breathless, and you'll be gasping for air as you're crying laughing. And it said powerhouse comic Ross Smith, and then this it just said bonkers Richard Todd.
And I love that though. I want to be the bonkers.
He was so annoyed because he's been doing comedy longer than any of us. Yeah. And he just goes, "Like, bonkers? What do you mean? Like, bonkers is just someone who's mentally ill but harmless." Just love that bonkers Richard Todd.
That's great. What do you get like sort of described as in them little?
Well, there was the nicest one I ever had was irreverent. The worst one I ever had was I think you told me once it was just a cheeky chappy.
Oh yeah, that's,
so it's
yeah,
just that, like I'm, it's.
What did I call you a cheeky?
No. You told me like someone just described me as a cheeky chappy.
Oh yeah, and then I was just
he's nice, but he's just a cheeky chappy. So it just jumps between that. It depends on how.
That was someone I know from the industry. Went to watch Mo and discovered that he was absolutely hammered.
Yeah.
And I mean, they should come back, you know. We get hammered together afterwards, but very professional beforehand. Very professional beforehand.
Yeah, picking him up. Yeah, he's great. He's brilliant. He gets there and he's just fucking hammered. Yeah, he's great. There's no darkness there at all. He's a cheeky chap.
Yeah, exactly. So there's no depth to it. It's just disrespect for the art form.
They do go for the kind of like surface explanation, don't they?
Yeah.
It's like the cheeky chap. I mean, they haven't got time or space to go into it, really.
But it does
seem a bit lazy because that's not the adjective I would reach for you. Yeah. Like, no. It's, you're more than that. Yeah, there's substantive.
I take the cheeky chappy part, but it's what's it called? I'd say I was more cheeky chappy than irreverent though, because irreverence sounds so big.
One I didn't like was genial. I didn't like that.
Genial? That's such a non-description.
Exactly, just genial. One I did is the guy, he's the director for Soho Theatre. He said, affable but dangerous. And I was like, oh, mate, I'm going to dine
that's
out.
That's a serial
on that
killer.
Oh, mate, I'll go for it. I don't mind. I'll go for affable but dangerous.
It comes on stage, we're in a cast.
Yeah. But dangerous is almost like it's one of those like like people who think that they're like Bill Hicks or think that they're
that's what I never wanted to be
in some way,
like they're, offensive they're comic. I've luckily managed to always avoid them. My worst fear is to be like seen as trying to be the edgy comic,
edgelord comic.
Edgelord.
Edgy is basically just a byword for offensive. That's what it is.
Oh, prick.
But like, needlessly offensive. Like there's there's no
joy to it.
And there's kind of no message behind the offence. It's just trying to wind people up. But then actually, I don't know. I like people who have a mischievous side who will purposely go, like Jordan Brooks will like purposely goad people sometimes.
Yeah.
And try and wind people. I quite enjoy the people who have, and Limmy as well. Like Limmy will like is a consummate wind-up merchant, so I do quite...
Also Adam Riley.
Me and him are doing AAA together. He's opening, I'm closing, it's Nicole Harris's MC.
Oh, you guys are all together.
He's
basically yesterday he was like this is in this like it was a all comics room. Okay, there's no two audience members and Adam Riley is getting destroying, like he's like, because he comes on stage a couple of the acts before that were talking about how porn and someone brought up pedophilia and something like that, and then Adam goes on, okay, and you see how menacing Adam looks, and he goes I watch a lot of porn, but my favorite sort of porn is female porn, and he starts going into it. He's like, I don't do it every day, you know, it's just like once every 6 months the fever comes over me. And it was that description, and it's just it was just that word fever. And it's like, I've got a girlfriend, I have a regular life.
But now the fever catches me. It's overwhelming.
And then it describes the whole genre, and then he's like, but it's, you know, it's just what you do, you know. You can't recreate what he does.
What's your porn preference?
Oh, mate.
What's your first keyword that you look for?
I am such a normie, okay, that I go by what I see first on the first homepage. Like, I choose from that. I can't even be bothered. Because I'll know I'll be in and out in about 90 seconds. So I don't want to pick that much time.
Okay,
now. I am so efficient.
So you're just like squeezing out like toothpaste.
Yeah, just live a little, mate.
No, there's like no enjoyment in it. Yeah. It's self-hatred.
I'm the same. It's like a stress relief. I'm just releasing, what's it called? Turning the radiator. What's it called when you turn the key in the radiator?
The radiator.
Bleeding the radiator. That's what wanking is.
Never ever refer to your penis as a radiator. Never refer to ejaculating as bleeding.
I'm just bleeding the radiator.
Both of you are mental, right? Because you've got to enjoy it. How long do
you
spend?
No, but you can't be tantric with yourself. You can't be stroking your body.
I don't go edging. And I like...
Look, there's some of them. Well, like, look, fair enough. I agree with you. What they've put on the shop window is probably good. Right? I think it's got there. There's pictures on there, brilliant. What I mean, but like there's sometimes when you think I'm not coming to that.
Yeah, I know, but you scroll down
yeah, you go on a little like sort of tangent, categories, don't you?
I just feel like the categories get so busy. And when I was younger, I used to be like, I would be maybe like every time I would, just before I'm about to leave the house, I'd be like, oh, I'm gonna quickly just do it and then go, and then I'd be like 20 minutes if I'm 20 minutes late to you, I was definitely pulling.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah,
I was definitely. It's like, especially if I'm a bit sweaty, because it's just like.
But like you do it like a sort of like a man who's just about to do his commute, and he's like, "Well, you know, I need to shave, but I'll shave in the time that I'm boiling the kettle."
It becomes part of my like get out the house routine. Shave, do this, do that.
Yeah,
and
but
then
send some emails
and then squeeze out a flop.
You know, just before I go, I'll do that. Shower, because I always got to shower afterwards to get all the sin off me.
And then do you ever get nostalgic for like videos that you've watched once and then you might try and find it?
I'll do that. These are my golden years.
I save links into my notes on my phone to revisit.
That's a good idea.
Never.
Because straight afterwards, I'm kind of that, you know, like you go from sort of Ted Bundy to Mother Teresa. You go from like, into this. And then you go, oh my God, what was I just doing? Me.
Close tab.
You see your reflection in the laptop screen. You're like, who are you? What's going on here?
I have a weird thing though, because it's like the loss of control and like the kind of stupidity of sex where you're like, you're tapping into your very like primitive baseline self. So then when you're having sex, when you get to that point where you stop being like self-conscious or feeling like, and you become like a fucking jibber jabber and just like lulling tongue.
What?
Right? And I remember, I remember once I had sex, sex with this girl. And I remember the next day she lived with my mate. She's a housemate. She spoke to my mate and my mate was like, what was it like? And she said, it's all right. And he was like, oh, what do you mean? She went, it got a bit licky. And it's like, I was like licking her like a frothy kitten, but not even, Jesus, in like an erotic way. It's like I was
a brilliant story, right, of like these comedians, like I'm not going to name them, but you probably will know them, where they were living together in Edinburgh, right, and one of them like brought a girl back, and then the next morning walked into the communal area and said to the other guy, was like, sorry if I was a bit loud last night. You probably heard us having sex. Mm-hmm. And the other comedian goes, I could hear you. So this comedian, like, there's nothing weirder for me when like, I live in a flat where the walls are really thin and like, the girl who lives next door to me, like always brings this guy back and I can only hear him. And I'm just like, what are you trying to prove, mate?
Lovely.
He doesn't know that, like he's in a fucking pie and mash shop.
Terrific.
Lovely.
Full up.
Well, it is that kind of like porn-informed sex, isn't it? Like, you don't want it to, but
when they say stuff, in porn, when they say stuff like, do you like that? Yeah. Do you like that? And it's like, don't talk.
Yeah, because it's not English in any way to do that. Yeah. So I do it in my stand-up, but like, I swear to God this happened. A girl did dirty talk, but she didn't understand that you got to put like a bit of oomph into it. You can't do it in your normal voice, right?
Oh,
so she was just doing it and she was just, it sounded sarcastic. She was just going, yeah, this is great. Yeah. Oh, you know what you're doing. It's like, you don't mean that though, do you? Like, this is really off-putting. I'm doing my best work and I'm just getting Louis Theroux style interactions back. Ridiculous. Oh. Right, we can talk about strangers.
Yes, okay, yeah. So this was the actual, I'll read it out so I forget what I write all the time. So this was the actual remit for the show, the bulk of the show. So the premise, you know, bottle episodes and TV series where the characters are like in a confined space and the bulk of the episode is driven by a dialogue, it's quite dialogic. And stuff like there's an episode in Bottom where they're just on a Ferris wheel, or in Breaking Bad where they're in the lab and they're trying to catch a fly. So the limited scope, the austere narrative, allows for a deeper penetrating conversation between the two characters, or an uncovering of their essential unity, stripped back, laid bare, the inexorable motion of two human beings in orbit. So very much and so I've had these incidents with strangers before. I'll cite two quick examples. One was just where a guy came on. It was actually, both of these weirdly enough involve homeless people, I've just realized. And that's fine because I was actually homeless for 3 days when I went to Glastonbury, so I can talk about homeless people and feel a real kinship and a connection with them.
Yeah, exactly.
You know,
it's not confused being at a festival with being homeless.
Three days. I was homeless at a festival.
So you were just living in a tent.
Exactly. So
Have you confused not having a tent with being homeless?
Yeah, exactly.
Because you weren't homeless, you were tentless.
I was. I wasn't really homeless, but I've never been to Glastonbury.
No,
fuck you both.
Oh, jokes on us.
Yeah. Whoa, don't I feel the fool?
Yeah.
So you were at Glastonbury and you were homeless.
Did you go
right?
to get, is this a real story?
No. I was making the thing of like, oh, like, it's fine, I can talk about homeless people because I'm down there with them.
Down
guys.
With the kids.
Homeless people. So the first one was when I was in the midst of drug addiction and my face like looked like a sinkhole, but I wasn't aware at this point of just how bad the kind of how much the drug use had affected my visage or how I looked. And I was on a tube and a kind of caricature of a homeless guy came in, like a smear of shit on his neck or something, you know, just a real like Dickensian homeless man came on. And with a pint of special brew and walked on, like looked round and kind of, you could see he felt unsettled because of the way he looked compared to all these like fresh faced morning commuters. But then he looked at me, zoned in, and raised up his can. It's like an expression of solidarity, like, we're in this together, mate, me and you. But I quite liked that. I liked that small moment of intimacy between me and this man, that he felt like, okay, he saw me as his like boy in the water. So it's like boy bobbing in the water, safety. Like there's someone
in the night.
There's someone with me. I can feel settled now because there's someone who's like me. Even though I was on my way to university, so so you know,
Jeez, wasn't that a big sign? No, nothing like you. No, yeah,
it would have been great if you got confused and went like, "Are you studying for your exams as well?"
Literature, mate.
Yeah, so you're in the SU.
£3 pint. £3 pint.
Snake bite.
Shit on his neck. That doesn't sound like any student though. That would be special brew. I remember when I first moved to London, and I was hanging out with these people who used to live on boats, and they were all like very like alternative. And once I was like, I brought a few drinks, we're all just gonna hang out, and I just brought different kinds of beers, like a massive bag of them, and one of them was K cider. And I really liked K cider when I first moved to London because I was like, it's strong, it's cheap, and da-da-da. And then I went, and then they were like, why are you drinking? These are alternative people. Like, that's what homeless people drink. Yeah. And I'm like, you guys are eating nettle soup. Isn't this a good accompaniment with nettle soup? They're like, no, that's weird. That is weird. You know, but did you speak to him?
No, he sat next to me at that point, and we kind of just had an exchange of like facial tics, kind of. It's all like we were flirting, but not. It was weird.
Smelling each other's
kind
butts.
It was kind of like a weird, like unspoken connection. It was nice.
I have a theory about this though, and I think that there's like some people who invite interaction with strangers, and there's some people who don't. Some people you'll hang about with for a day, and you'll kind of like, a lot of the time it's comedians. You'll kind of understand like why they're like, because they just somehow, people like that gravitate towards them. Whereas like with me, that doesn't really happen that much. Like, I don't know why, but I don't really invite those sort of things. And so as soon as they do, but these people are just like, they'll just chat to somebody or they'll do these things and they'll invite that in.
Richard is a real like, people chat to him.
Yeah.
He invites, you know, Richard, whose accent you're doing earlier, he's like, because he works with people like that as well. Yeah. So he's like, although those interactions happen to me, it's normally when I'm under the influence. When I'm dead sober in the day, I hate it. Like, I hate walking through East London.
I have it all the time. I mean, I care for the elderly, like, despite what I said earlier on, I actually really care. I really, really care and have a lot of compassion for these people. So I seem to collect waifs and strays because I think it's just kind of treating
people
they can say I'm just treating like a human being and like connecting with them on a human level. And that sort of brings me to my next one quickly. Was when me and Ben Tarjay, we stayed in this big Georgian building as part of an artist residency, and we were forewarned, like, I was on a 14-hour shift, so I came home about 1 in the morning, and we were forewarned that this woman had been in earlier on in the day, kind of really unsettled and confused, kept thinking that this was the site where she was going to get married to someone called like Domingo, or he had like a Spanish name or something, and that her parents were buried under the house. And they were like, yeah, she's come back a few times, we've kind of spoken to her and tried to help her, but obviously schizophrenic, so it's hard to comprehend exactly what she needs. So I turned out, and this was on Halloween as well. So I turned up at 3 a.m. It's this big Georgian building, like in a vast, desolate landscape, like this big field. There's no one else around, completely pitch black. And she's at the front door like a ghoul. And because I was really tired, I kind of went and went, oh, you're right. You're the one who came here earlier on. And she wasn't really speaking to me. And then there was that thing of like, I was slowly closing the door, but I thought, I can't leave this woman. This is awful. I can't leave this. I went, I'll come in. I went, this isn't my place, so I can't allow you to sleep here or like have a bath now, which I would love to just be able to give you that option. And she was really tweaky and kind of intense. And she kept like picking up like knives and stuff when we was in the kitchen. I was making a Nutella on toast. And so it was a very like spinning plates. I kind of had to
keep manage. Watching her.
Yeah, I had to kind of like learn to manage her mood. Mm-hmm. But then she started getting into doing like Harry Enfield impressions. She was like, I love that Harry Enfield, like, I really love it. But she was like doing Harriet, but it wasn't just Harry Enfield, it was like Zoolander was in there, and but all under the all under the thing of this is all Harry Enfield. And, like and then she's a bit of Little Britain. She's like, I love that. I love Harry Enfield. And so I was doing it with her, but like after 2 hours of this, I was like exhausted. And I said to her, look, I'll walk with you to the nearest homeless shelter, or if you're not comfortable with that, I can order and pay for you to have a taxi, whatever it is. And she was like, no, I'm not staying. I'm not staying. I'm getting married here. My parents are buried. I'm not leaving. And it became like a bit home invasion-y.
We were
in the front of the lobby, and in the end, I had to call the police. And I said, look, she's not intruded. She's not broken in. I invited her in. She hasn't broken any laws, but she doesn't want to leave, so I kind of need a third party here. And while we were waiting for the police, it was like for hours, it was through the night, it became this weird psycho familial drama where me and her were like in like a loveless marriage, and she would like go, Harry Enfield impression, remember that? I was like, enough of the Harry Enfield impression. We've had years of this. And then it became this thing, and like I went, like, there's a bit when I went, I went, look, I understand. I know what it's like, I'm a drug addict. She went, what are you talking about? I went, I'm a drug addict. She went, I'm not a drug addict. I'm not some weak drug addict. I was like, fuck you, Clarissa. I gave you Nutella. Like, what are you doing to me, Clarissa?
She has standards.
And it became this weird back and forth. And ended up by the time the police were here, and she was like, I was like, just shut up, Clarissa. That's enough of your mental now. Like, we've had hours of this. Just shut up, Clarissa. The police kind of like spoke to her. She was, I feel for her. But then the next, so she got taken away, and then I went upstairs, went asleep. Ben was like probably listening at the door, but scared to come down. So yeah. Ben didn't intervene at any point.
He didn't interact.
Yeah.
No.
And then, but then the next morning when I came down the stairs, she was there again. She'd broken it, or not broken it. She'd come into the property again. A new set of policemen were here, and I just kind of like fist bumped her and left. Because the day staff were like dealing with it at that point, the people.
I had something not that similar.
Yeah,
but basically, I was living in Walthamstow at the time. I just moved into this place. It was a bare bones apartment. Like, I just got a bit of money, and I was using it to, you pay the deposit and you pay the thing, and it's like I'm sleeping. I could afford bed sheets, but I was sleeping with my coat and using my balled up clothes to sleep on. And it was just this bare bones room. And one day I'm walking home from a gig, and this homeless guy just like jumps off the bus, and I comes running up next to him, and he's like, hey man, would you like a beer? And I was also drunk, so I was like, yeah, of course. And then I took the beer and we're drinking together and we're chatting. And then he was like, hey, listen, bro, I need some money. Someone just gave me these beers, but I can swap it if you can give me a bit of money. And I was like, I am skint, mate. I'm walking home, so I don't have any money to give you. I've just caught the bus. He must have followed me off the bus. And then I was like, but you know what? Great idea. This is what I can do. And I took him home. And I was living with, like, my house was basically an Albanian family lived downstairs. Upstairs were three different guys, and then there was my room in the middle landing. And I was like, you can sleep in my room and I'll sleep downstairs in the living room.
Oh.
And then in the morning, I can't help you, but I can give you a warm bed tonight. And he was just like, okay, cool. So I walk him downstairs, and he's like, I have a bit of hash as well if you want to smoke. And I was like, I don't smoke, man, but please feel free. So I take him to the room. And then as I'm leaving the room, which is just a habit of mine, I lock the door. And I go downstairs and I go to sleep. And I give him everything. I give him a big bowl of water. I give him like all food, blah, blah, blah. And then I come back upstairs in the morning. I open up. And I didn't realize I'd locked him in. And he was like, no, but it's fine. It's fine. I was just sleeping. And I was like, okay, cool. No worries. And then I walk him out and he leaves. And then I walk back into my room and I'm like, okay, I can relax again. I haven't got anything to do for another few hours. But there's this tang in the room. There's this tang that I can't work out where the smell is coming from, but I ignore it and I leave. I go to my friend's house, which is like a walk away, 15-minute walk away. I come back then, like I crashed at their place because we all got drunk. I walked back to the house the next day, and I come back and my room stinks. Like it is. And then at one point, I just see a glass under the, there's a table next to my bed, and there's a second level, and I pick it up, and I'm like, ooh! He had peed in the pint glass I'd given him of water, because something went in, something must have come out, and I was like, I was like walking, and then I literally had to go to the toilet, and the toilet was on the other side of the landing, so I was carrying it, and it was full to the brim.
And what hue was it? What
oh
color?
My god, it was radioactive brown. Yeah, it was like muddy. Like that guy was not gonna. And then I basically tipped
that guy
out
had
of it.
No kidneys.
No, nothing.
It's like his kidneys had fallen out.
and then a few months later, even months later, I'm at work, and I'm stood outside. I'm like having a cigarette, and this guy comes up to me, the short black guy, and he's just like, "Hey, man, do you remember me?" And I was like, "No, I'm sorry, I don't have any memory." Because that's the worst thing about doing stuff when you're drunk is you have no memory of it, let alone the other person. And he was like, "Oh, you." And then he was with this other woman who was apparently his like older sister, who was like he was living with at the time. He like cleaned up a bit, and he was like, "Oh, this guy gave me a place to stay for a night, and he gave me his number and stuff." I gave him my number because he said he was a musician, and I said to him, "I work at an open mic. If you want to come along."
Fuck me, mate.
And luckily, he'd never taken me up on the offer. But and then he was like, "Oh, hi, man. Would you like a pizza? Because we did pizza." And he was like, "Yeah, please. Because we just made an accident pizza." I just gave that to him, and I was like, "That's the epilogue of the story." He was gone. But the only reason I did that was because the random act of like when people do, because this my second story was basically I was 19, and I'd gone interrailing with my friends, but while everyone else had a bit of money, I had literally spent everything I owned on the Interrail ticket, and I was living bare bones, living from place to place, like eating like everything from the Lidl's in Germany or the Lidl's in thing. And just like, I remember I was on the train with my friend. And I was like, "There is no honor in poverty. Like, why am I doing this? Yeah. Why did I come all the way to this country to be a refugee again?"
Yeah.
Like this, it felt like I was a refugee. I was just struggling, barely eating. And I got sick because I bought myself 120 grams of Marlboro tobacco. And instead of eating, I would smoke as much as I could. And meals places I had water things, so I was eating and it was terrible. And any money I did have, I'd spend it on drinks.
I remember that kind of asceticism, and it was self-imposed. Where we were, because I would always prioritize like drinks or drugs.
Exactly.
And I remember one week where for some reason my mate had like, I don't know, like £9 or something. He's like, "Okay, I'm going to get some supplies just to last us a week," because we'd spent all our money on like methadone and speed. Cider or something. And but then he came back with like bolognese sauce, but no pasta. Meat or pasta.
Yeah.
And then fucking like 3 jars of periwinkles.
What?
Like periwinkles in a...
What's
in
periwinkles?
A like they're like the little things you pick out with like a toothpick. Like this, they're like little snails, basically. Like periwinkles. And then I can't remember. They're like peanut butter or something like that. And I remember we subsisted on like this, like 3 jars of like periwinkles. Jesus, and like absolute hunger. And at the beginning, you're thinking, okay, I might try and embrace this poverty, this different way of there might be, like you said, like a nobility in it, or kind of spirituality in it. There fucking ain't.
No, really.
Isn't. When you get to the point where like your bowels start to like just disintegrate, and you're like, there's nothing to this. This is horrible.
And that happened to me. And like throughout that, there would always be people who give you a bit of food. And then I got so ill that by the time I got to Austria, my parents and my sisters and all this stuff, they all pulled together to get me a plane to get back, because I was literally in bed in the hostels, just like unable to move, moving from hostel to hostel, just staying in bed. And my friends and everyone was like, he's not in a good way. Yeah. You should send him home. And I get back, and EasyJet flight. Yeah, fuck you, EasyJet. Okay, because the plane was 5 hours delayed, and my sisters had bought me the flight and the train ticket, and it was they left a 2-hour gap between that. And even though, so because I was 5 hours late, I missed my train, and I'd already published a ticket, and they were like, "We're not going to help you. We're not going to get you another train. You've already printed the ticket." And I was like, so I was just sat in Paddington, just literally like, and there's this cleaner following me around, like every corner I try and sleep in. she would just come to that one.
Yeah.
And eventually my family noticed, and then £20 gets, because I kept checking my account on the cash machine, just like, some money. I don't have a phone. I don't have any sort of way to contact anyone. No one knows where I am. And £20 comes in, and I'm like, okay, I know my sisters live around the Islington area. So I go to the taxi drivers, and I speak to the first one. He was Muslim, and I was like, oh, he'll definitely help me. Because I had this idea that a Muslim guy would help me because we're both Muslim. And he says, no, I'm working. The second guy, no, I'm busy. Third guy, no, I'm not there. And then the fourth guy was this white guy, and I was just like, oh, he's definitely not going to help me out. And he was like, oh, son, jump in. And I'm like literally laying on the back seat. Just, he was like, what's wrong? And I was in this like just complaining to him. Just like for the, and he literally, what he did was he drove around Canterbury, literally, because I knew that there was a bus that my sisters lived near. I didn't have an address or anything. And he just found out the route of the bus and then followed the bus and then got me to the park that's near my sister's and which I knew the way from.
Yeah.
And I was like, here's the £20, I promised. And he's like, no, don't worry about it. And he waited outside. And literally that whole time, I was in that taxi for like at least an hour.
Yeah.
Just like laying down on the back, because you keep getting these like pangs because your body's just like, oh, it was terrible.
Your stomach's eating itself.
Yeah, I never did that again. Point, yeah. This is why I hate traveling. Without any, I need an A to B.
Yes.
I want guarantee that everything will be okay from A to B.
Yeah.
I do not like risking it, plan
a
everything.
Hand to mouth existence.
No, never, yeah, never.
Yeah. It seems fun or like a bit of an adventure off.
And if you've never experienced it before, it seems fun.
Yeah.
And if you have a safety net, if there's a safety net, if there's no safety net, if you don't have any phone and blah, 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 blah. Like, and there were times like because that's my third story. During that trip, I was in Naples. And the way I'd worked out was whenever I get to a new place, if I wasn't with my friends, because I'd left them in Rome because these gypsies tried to rob me. At least I got back on the train, went to Naples. And because in the Interrail card, if you use travel on the same day, it counts as the same hole punch. And I arrive in Naples and I'm like, okay, if I walk straight, I'll eventually hit a computer shop. So I kept walking straight. And I did hit a computer shop. And luckily there was a guy in there who was Somali and he spoke Italian. Mm-hmm. So he helped me on the computers to book a hostel and all this stuff. And then literally like, he was like, oh, you're lucky. So this is the whole Somali, you've walked into the Somali area. And I'm Somali, and I was like, "This, how did I end up in the one?" He was like, literally, if you'd walked one street up, there's a mosque, and there's a da-da-da, and there's a da-da-da. This is the whole Somali community.
Yeah.
And he said, Somalis always live, when they see the first tall buildings, they stop. So if you get to any city, always walk. If you think there's any Somalis there, it'll be at the first tall building.
Really?
No, it's a joke. He was just like,
I'm such a white Westerner. Like, really? tell me more of your
story. And he was like, he walked me around. He took me to a restaurant. He like took me, he made me pray. I don't pray. I never pray. But it's like, this guy's paying your food bill. You pray. You're like, yeah. He was like, do you pray 5 times a day? I was like, yes. Yeah, of course I do. And then I got to the hostel. It was fine. I just slept for like 3 days in the hostel. And luckily my friends from college, who was Italian, him and his granddad picked me up. That's another story though. But yeah, those are my three.
That's great. That's great, mate. You've had a very kind of peripatetic lifestyle. Very
it's hot. I would never wish that on my, if I send my kids away and they were like, which kind of like going to work out? I was like, I want, like, because I knew I would, do you know that feeling you get when you're like, I'll be okay.
Yeah.
I know I'll be okay. But imagine if you put, this is why I think.
It's somebody, well, the thing is that what I want to say about it is that there's kind of, for people who are practical people and worried about things, there is a kind of like, a sort of temptation to be like that, you know, like a temptation to go, well, imagine if you were just free and fuck it all and do these sort of things. And like, so growing up, you know, you read novels
Kerouac.
Like The Road,
yeah,
and all these different things, and you think, I'd love to be like that, and you see your friends, but then you know that there's always going to be a practicality that stops you doing that.
Yes.
So it's like, I would constantly have to ring my mum, I'd have to do that,
you know.
And I'd have to let people know where I was. I couldn't just do this thing of going like, well, fuck it all, you know, I don't have any money, but I'll live and I'll do this. It's like, I need that practicality there. So when you say these things of like speaking to strangers, I think that the reason that you know, I can maybe engage in that from time to time is that I know that it's for a limited point of time. I know that it's going to be for a night, or I know that it's going to be for the tube journey or the train journey. And I also think like there's a sort of inherent kindness to quite a lot of British culture where you know, that like if there's somebody in need or there's somebody in a situation, then people 9 times out of 10 want to help.
Yeah, they'll get you at least closer to your B point.
Yeah.
Like there's and it's, I think that's the one thing those prolonged interactions with strangers teaches you is that the not to sound like Balamori at the end of the day, but at the end of the day, we are all, it's basically two human beings and everything else. When put two, have you ever had that when two people are really, when you and another person are both equals? Because you're both desperate.
Well, that's all the ideas. Whole point. Yeah, it's a very leveling experience. And this, what I've said, like it's like stripping everything back down to basic unity between you and another person. And that's what these kind of these moments can have. You have a lot of those moments, like in the care home, when you're very intimately wrapped up in these people's lives, people who are usually very scared because of the dementia and they're confused. And you become, I mean, for them, like, I'm like an absolute familiar face. They know me. I'm like an extension to their family.
Yeah.
So you know that you even if they've got a slightly fragmented cognizance and stuff like that, you can still really connect and engage and with them on a human level.
But it only works if the person, because most of the times the two people don't meet on an equal level. They meet as one having the power and one not having the power. And it takes the person who has the power, like, willing to let, or you can either, like you said, you don't want the interaction for long. And it takes someone who is willing to, like, invest. It can go from both extremes.
Well, like, here's the thing, though, is that there's kind of things where, for me, like, the way I live my life is that it's mad, but, like, what your parents instill in you is, like, what goes with you everywhere. So there'll be times, like, you know, I mean, the strangest stories that I can think of, one, obviously, I went on holiday with some strangers because they invited me, but I thought that would be an adventure to get out of my comfort zone.
Yeah.
Another one I can think of is in Edinburgh, I witnessed a man have a seizure.
Yeah.
So there was just a man walking down the street and he just had a seizure, and it was amazing because suddenly all these people just sprung into action. So I had my flyers in my hand. I ran over. Three or four other people ran over. Somebody put something under his head, did these things, and we all sprang into action. It was like, you go and get water. You, like, I had an umbrella and I was holding an umbrella above him. Somebody else was holding an umbrella above him. And suddenly these people knew exactly what to do. They were like, right, get his wallet out, find out who he is, if he's got any things like that. Right, ring these people, do these sort of things.
Yeah.
And, you know, I was thinking, well, might fly these guys. But, you know, like, I was just, you know.
We all need a bit of fun now.
Why
don't you come to
Jeff? But it was amazing, though, because it's like, I think that when it comes down to necessity like that, like, I think that, you know, people are inherently good. And, like, there is a sort of lack of trust. You know, I read a story in America where they sent a robot out hitchhiking. They were like, look, people don't trust each other anymore, you know, we should be able to hitchhike, like, people are inherently good, all these sort of things. On the third day, they found that robot decapitated. So you know, that's the kind of thing, isn't it, you know, like, like, there is an inherent distrust, but then there's also a thing of, like, you know, if I walk past somebody crying, I can't turn around and be like, I'm just going to walk past and not deal with that. I have to ask, I have to, you know, do these sort of things.
The crying thing, just because I'm uncomfortable. If someone was crying in front of me, I remember once my friend's girlfriend was upset about something, and I just kind of, like, patted her on the head, and then pointed at, I said, "Your boyfriend's there," and just kind of sent her towards him. Yeah. But if someone's down and out, that it has to, like, I think most of the time when I've been helped or I've helped someone, it's when they're at an extreme. It's like, do you know those people who come up to you when you're in the smoking area and they're like, hey man, have you got a cigarette? And you're like, you're in a club, you're drinking, you're buying drinks. I do not think it's a pro. I do not feel the need to share, because we're both equals in this.
But that power thing you said about is so interesting, because I'm exactly the same. Like, I can just think of the times where I have sort of spoken to homeless people. There is this kind of, like, inherent thing of you feeling like almost like a youth counselor.
Yes,
you
know what
I mean? That's why I hate the stop and crouch. When people do the stop and crouch horrible. With homeless people,
I start talking to them. They pat the dog and they, like, sit down next to them.
So you're having a tough time, buddy.
That's what I was like, though, man. I remember being drunk and saying to this guy, "Look, I'm not going to give you any money, but I'll buy you a Burger King." And this guy's like, "Yeah, fine." And, like, we were just in the queue and we were chatting, like, and I sort of became like some sort of, like, drugs counselor. Like, What is it you're on? Is it Smack?
I just
you can tell me.
Taking a few wrong turns.
Either just give them the money, or give them. If you have something in your hand and you don't have anything else, you give them that. But I hate it when people make the homeless person interact with them, because it's like that homeless person doesn't have any. It's like, what? I don't want to talk to you.
Yeah, exactly.
I want something you have, but I don't want you.
Like they have to endure the conversation just to get the £1.50.
The same as like when you're younger, like having to sort of chat to your nan.
Go on,
give your nan a kiss get the sweet. And you're
thank you, I don't want to.
Go on, you got to wear the jumper your nan gave you for Christmas. Yeah. It's like, oh.
Giving shouldn't make you feel good.
There's no fundamentally selfless act, but it's about ratios.
Yeah.
So if... actually the selfless part of that act outweighs the it's made me feel a bit good about myself, then it's, you know, you're doing a pretty decent
thing. My friend once said to me, there was this old lady, she was leaving Home Bargains and she was struggling with her bags, and this is why I'm starting to become more and more like closed off, because she was walking with all these heavy bags, and I just helped her pick them up. I walked her to, she was walking to the this tea place, and I carried it with her, and then her my friends were with me, and they were like, we're in a rush, and I was like, well, it's on our way, we're just gonna cross the road, we're gonna drop it off, and then I put it down, and then he was like, did that make you feel better? Did that make you feel, do you feel like a good person? And it's like, those people who do that ruin it for you, because
it's like we have, me and Ben, where we do like the care home tour, we've had like a documentary crew following us around, and just that in itself, we're like, actually, like we started we had to kind of like evaluate our reasons for doing this, and thinking, okay, a good act shouldn't have like an accompanying PR machine.
I understand that.
Documentary crew.
It went from like when I was a kid it used to piss my mom off once. We got a bit of money, and she'd hidden it, and I'd found it, and so I was stood on the street just handing it out to not even, and then like a lady who's our neighbor saw me, and she knocked on my mom's door and was like, you know, your son's giving away money. I don't know where he's gotten the money, but he's just giving money away. And I went from that to now, when I see a homeless person, I'm like, I'm instead of just doing the nice act and dealing with that, I'm worried. What is the repercussions? Why am I doing it? That self doubt.
At that point, the homeless person's like, I don't give a fuck if you're doing this for yourself, mate. I just want to.
And at the end of the day, I think it's like, I don't know. It's worrying about being selfish in your altruism, and I think that as long as you don't go around spouting what you did,
exactly. Those are the people who ruin it for. Like, because when you see people doing that, who make those massive statuses about the good thing they did, and then like you're like, oh, you've made me reassess my own, like, when I never even thought about, when, because most of the time when I do stuff, I'm drunk, I'm not really aware of it.
There shouldn't have to be like a record of your goodwill. Just if you do it in that moment,
and they share it as a memory. Yeah.
There's a difference, though, isn't there, between interacting with a stranger for some sort of reason, for some sort of need, and being caught with a stranger. That's the issue here, isn't it?
This is quickly going back to, just because this is what I found absolutely fascinating about your show, Ross. When it initially came out, I thought, this is a really good concept, but how are you going to deal with the idea of that you were like kind of purposely engineering the situation to get the Edinburgh Hour, to have the adventure? And I thought, I wonder if he addresses that in the show, and you did. And I thought, this is like great. It's like really funny show. Just as it was, like, really brilliant. But then appending that with that at the end, and then going into that, I found, oh God, this adds a whole nother layer, which I found really fascinating.
It's more about, like, as I said, that practicality always comes back in. And, you know, even if you put yourselves out of your comfort zone, I don't think anybody truly ever does.
No.
Because you can't get past that, like, that self of what you are. You can't get past that. So I had to, obviously, I'm like, stand up is self awareness, and I knew for a fact that everybody was going to go, well, this isn't your character, so you've done this for a reason. And especially as I was telling everybody about it and milking it for everything. Everybody's going to know that thing. So it was like, I'm putting myself in this thing that I would never normally do, and here's the reason why. It's not just I'm doing it to better better myself. I'm doing it to do these things. I'm doing it for a social experiment, basically. Yeah. A social experiment that I can turn into an Edinburgh show. But it also, like, it was really gratifying because I think that a lot of the time you grow up and people will tell you that the world is, you know, dangerous and anthropologically in a big city you have to be your own tribe. You can't be part of a tribe, like, no. In a village you're part of a tribe. Yeah. Everybody knows everybody. In a in a city you're one person. So like it kind of made me feel a bit like there's not that much to be scared of, really, like even if you go headlong into it. I mean, until you're murdered, obviously there's
but there's this thing about, because they were going with you, they were going to a strange place, they were going with you. Unless it was a murder plot, it would just be everyone out is out of their comfort. Because you said that you were like they were just as uncomfortable as you.
Yeah, they were, and also like I think that situations like that, English people kind of hate being out of their comfort zone and being uncomfortable and confronting strangers. Like I talk about it a lot, but like small talk is like the funniest thing to me because it's so English and it's sort of like we're just going to say the base thing here, try and make each other laugh, keep it under a minute, and then we're going to carry on.
When I went to Finland, there was a girl that I'd got off with in Hackney. She was Finnish. I went over to Finland just on my own, like I got on holiday on my own, and she saw I was there and she was like, let's meet up. We didn't know each other at all. Mm-hmm. We just snogged one night and that was it. So we went over there and I was like, when we got talking, I'm like a big rabbit on I'm like a big conversationalist. I just bang on all the time. And so when I got talking, when I met up with her, I was talking, she wasn't really reciprocating it. I thought, I don't know if this is going well. And then she went, not to be rude, just shut up. And I was like, what? Yeah. She went, not. She went, us Finnish, we don't do small talk. We don't, like, you don't need to do this bit. Yeah. Let's just walk in silence. It's fine.
I love those people.
I know. And then when we got to the cafe that we were going to by the river, then when we were talking, like we both just went deep, like it's a deep dive into our lives. Mm-hmm. We really connected, really bonded. Mm-hmm. And it was like, that's the way they do it. It's like either we have a conversation that's substantive or substantive. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or no worse. Yeah. So yeah, either way. Or we don't at all.
And I thought, I can think of two instances, right, where it's like people who do that. I think it's, honestly, it's so weird that we do it. And I don't think it's in many other cultures. Because, like, you know, getting a haircut, right, for me, that is like, the thing with being with a stranger in that environment is, say it's someone you know, small talk's fine. But it's when you're caught in those situations with a stranger where suddenly small talk becomes bigger and you're suddenly forced to do those things. So when you're getting a haircut, you're there for half an hour. 45 minutes, right? Like, you can't sit there in silence. That guy can't sit there in silence. Oh. So they have to ask you these bullshit questions. Where are you going on holiday? What did you do? All these different things. It's just like surface questions. And not only that, but you're looking yourself in a mirror the whole time. You're looking at your own soul going like, I don't do that. Why am I lying to this person? Why do I want to impress this person? Like, and, you know, another thing is when, I don't know if you ever had it, but when you're like, say you're with somebody that you know, like a girlfriend or something, and they'll bring out a friend, and then that person, there'll be three of you, and then that person will go, I'm just going to go to the toilet. You guys stay here. And the panic in both of your eyes of going, what? You're leaving us here to chat.
You're the glue.
I don't know. I love small. Somalis do loads of small talk. But our small talk is, Somalis will talk about anything. And like my friend's mum used to tell me about the care home she used to work in. The old Somali men used to just have Al Jazeera on in the background and discuss whatever was on that TV. And they could sit there for hours and just keep talking. And they're not friends. If she came into the room, they would involve her in the conversation and they can't.
I quite like that as well. Like that, just like shooting the shit thing where feel like you just, I'm like that. See, I'm more predisposed to that kind of talk.
Even if it's empty.
Shoot the shit all day long.
Yeah. Like me and my friends, I remember as a kid, didn't you remember as a kid, like being in your friend's house before you drank, before any substances whatever ingested, before you had anything to do, you could spend days with your friend and never remember what you talked about.
Days would go by. It's a bit of a bunker mentality. It's like you're trapped in a bunker to go and you're just going back and forth and then and you don't, it's very very small, like crumbs of the conversation.
That's why black people do so well in prison.
It's good in those situations because you can reinvent yourself. Like I've stayed in hostels before and you know that it's like this kind of like what is it in Fight Club? Single serving friend. Yeah. You know what I mean? It's like for one little bit. And for a night, you can just be whoever the fuck you want to be to these American tourists. You know, you can do these sort of things. Like when I moved down to London, I could not afford a flat. Mm. So what I'd do is just stay in hostels for like, it was only for like a couple of weeks. Mm. It was so insane because like that person would be there for a night and then they'd be gone again. So you could just do whatever the hell you wanted.
See, I'm the opposite. I don't like to kind of reinvent myself. I like to give them the full force of my personality.
And I get in trouble for that.
Like, to the point where they're like, mate, we don't need to know this much about you.
You've seen us too intense.
And I'm like, mate, here's that.
Aggressively friendly.
Yeah, yeah. In 1997, this is what I was doing.
I have an issue where I jump, I assume that this person has all the context and I'm pulling their leg, but they were like, why is this guy such a prick to me? Yeah. Why does he don't like me? And it's like, I'm treating you as if you're my best friend.
But that's a self-defense mechanism because I do exactly the same. Like I'll walk up to a stranger and just be like, your hair looks shit.
Exactly.
I expect them to get the joke, you know what I mean? But they don't. They just think, who the hell was this prick? Like, but I just think that's my defense mechanism. If you don't get past that, if you don't understand that this is a gag, then
there's like, because the whole idea of, I've always had the issue with, especially in green rooms, I had to learn that recently, that you can't be aggressively yourself straight away. Like, well, this is how a green room goes. It starts with everyone quietly on their phones. By the first interval, everyone's like maybe chatting. By the second interval, everyone kind of knows each other and everyone's stuck around. That means that person's like willing to talk. And by the end, everyone's like friendly and blah, blah, blah. It's like the first day of school every single night. Yeah. And it's,
You're going hard straight away. Like, slacking everyone off.
Oh, this guy knows.
Roast battle. We don't want a roast battle. We just want to calm down, mate.
Ironically, I'm terrible at roast battles. So my thing is just being overtly friendly and being like,
Yeah, but I don't trust those people, man. When they're overtly friendly, I just look at them and think, where are the bodies buried? Like, honestly, I just think, what are you doing? Those inherently positive people, I just think.
I just think it's harder to be positive than it is to be negative. So I'm like, I think if someone's like being really nice, I know it's not them being their most true selves, but it's I'm putting in an effort. So should you. And then if we want to, a few hours in, we'll be more real. But you shouldn't start from zero and work to five. You should start at 10 and then comfortably settle at five.
Right.
So I do the thing of like, I find actual people inherently fascinating and interesting. Mm. I think even if outwardly they seem quite boring, it's sometimes they can be so boring that fascinates me. I've got to work. A bus mate who's like this 65-year-old engineer, and like he makes like tractor equipment, he makes farming equipment, and he's as boring as hell. But so I like to excavate that. I want to know what you're about, mate. So then I end up probably excavating.
And he shows you
much.
The bodies.
But do you know what I mean? Because like weirdly, like right, okay. So the upshot of this whole thing is that I don't really like getting in situations with strangers. I don't know why. It's like an anxious thing, and it's also like you have to confront yourself, right? That is the worst thing. Is that in that situation you have to confront yourself, like who you are and who you are to this person.
Yeah.
And it's like forced upon you. It's not like something you can prepare for. It's forced upon you. Whereas I love putting other people in that situation. So say I'm out with two groups of friends, you know, you've all got like groups of friends of like, these are the people that I knew in school, these are the people that I know from comedy, these are the people that I know from uni or something right? I love taking someone from one group and introducing them to a person from the other group. And just going like, because it's fascinating to watch. Just like, how are you two going
to
watch this?
I tried to create an awkward party once where I invited like loads of disparate people from my life, or like people I had like a really kind of like a very basic kind of interaction with, like the guy who used to sell me vodka at the corner shop and invited all these weird people, but it didn't work.
Your brain is like a sort of sitcom crossover episode where you're just going like, hold on, why are you talking to this person?
But the main thing wrapping up, like you talk about, I don't like being in situations with strangers. I don't like being in situations with loved ones, basically. I don't like being in a situation with intimates or loved ones, so I try and surround myself with strangers.
I think that after a while, sort of loved ones end up sort of becoming strangers as you grow up and grow apart. Like that's no more, that's no more sort of indicative than when you get a Christmas present and you're like, why have you got me a train pencil case? Like, I've never said I like trains, I've got, and I've got no need for pencils.
I've already got five compasses, mate. I don't need another compass.
It's like they hinge off one thing as well. They'll go like, you mention that you quite like golf, and they'll just go, oh, I've got your golf stuff again. And
you're golf
like,
crazy rock!
Classic.
That's what they hinge it off.
All right, guys. Thank you so much for coming on. It's been great conversation. So thanks again. First episode.
We got into it, yeah.